Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.
We acknowledge the land we meet on today as the traditional land for the Kaurna people, and we respect their spiritual relationship with their country. We also acknowledge the Kaurna people as the custodians of the Adelaide region, and that their cultural and heritage beliefs are still important to living Kaurna people today. We also pay respects to the cultural authority of Aboriginal people visiting from other areas of South Australia. The words for today's chalice reading come from the Global Chalice Lighting October 2021, and they're offered by Dorothea Kaufmann, Unitarian Religionsangemeinschaft Freien Glaubens, Germany. And I'd like to ask Cleo if she'd light the chalice this morning. It begins with a quote from Goethe. If not the eye was like the sun, it could not see the sun's majestic shine. If not God's magic was in everyone, who could rejoice over anything divine? From the bottom of my very existence, I am pervaded with light energy, shining colours to my eye, warmth to my skin, inspiration to my soul. In this unity of creative sparks and sparkling creation, life unfolds. Let us open our senses to the light within and around us and send it out with shining examples into the world. Welcome to today's service. We are an inclusive community and accept everyone regardless of their religious persuasion, gender identification or ethnic origin. It doesn't matter whom you love or worship, you're welcome in this space. We hope you can stay for tea, coffee and conversation, especially warm welcome to anyone who we don't see so often here today, and visitors. You're very welcome at the coffee time to take a chair outside to sit and chat. If you stay inside, try to be very mindful of social distancing and wearing a mask until you're seated and enjoying the cuppa. Today's service topic is bread, as in, give us this day our daily bread. Bread is a primary metaphor in mainstream Christianity to the Eucharist, a ceremony we don't conduct in Unitarian churches. This is not to say that the divine or transcendent don't belong in this space. In the Lord's Prayer, give us our daily bread, means the food we need. Bread is the staff of life, and it is from this thought that the content of today's service will come. I thought we'd start with candles of sharing today. It's our tradition to share the significant events of our spiritual life in an open forum. I invite you to deepen and bind that relationship by sharing any recent event that has been significant in your spiritual life. I'll begin by lighting the first candle. Do come and light a candle in silence if you prefer, or to tell us something about it. Today's reading is from Chloe Tiada, editor, baker and HuffPost writer from Canada. Bread isn't mere food, it's a metaphor, symbol and summation of a larger journey through life and self-ownership. Making bread at home, like canning, veggie gardening or hunting, is being involved with what you eat. A lot of us turn to baking, she says, when we're feeling low. Melanie Denyer, the founder of the Depressed Cake Shop, isn't that brilliant? A bakery whose role it is to raise awareness about mental health issues, told BBC News, some of us even started baking because they were ill and needed something simple as a focus, and there is something genuinely therapeutic about baking. Homemade bread is more delicious because you can customise the bread to be whatever flavour you want. You can choose this kind of flour, white, whole wheat, eggs, dairy. You can control the amount of sugar that goes in, and you don't have to worry about added fructose, corn syrup or dextrose because they add empty calories. You just don't do it. Homemade bread also has lower sodium and it doesn't contain trans fat unless you add margarine or vegetable shortening instead of olive oil. Commercially produced bread will also contain preservatives and artificial ingredients to give it more flavour and a lengthier shelf life. But aside from the nutritional value, baking your own bread is good for mental health. Mixing the ingredients, kneading the bread. If you ever find yourself frustrated or angry, you can always take it out on dough. It's very satisfying. And watching the dough rise can be very soothing. In 2017, five people who were mental health residents at Bethlehem Royal Hospital spent 6 2-hour sessions baking bread by hand and answering weekly questions about how they felt. They reported feeling happier, creative, and having a sense of achievement. They also revealed that baking bread made them feel relaxed, less anxious, and they had a sense of purpose. There's nothing more satisfying than pulling a freshly baked loaf out of the oven. It's a comforting smell, there's that first bite, and the satisfaction of a full belly that makes us feel warm and cosy. And Bethlehem Royal Hospital, by the way, is Bedlam. That's where that infamous, absolutely infamous mental health establishment in the 19th century, but it's transformed itself for the better. He's got a lovely voice. He had a bad run-in with cancer, which he seems to have got through. You still see David Hobson being programmed in Sydney. Now, bread isn't mere food. It's a metaphor, symbol and summation of a larger journey through life. We began today with Jesse Norman's rendition of Panis Angelicus, which has the most angelic of tunes and the most Catholic of words. Panis Angelicus, bread of angels becomes the bread of men. Oh, miraculous thing, this body of God will nourish even the poorest, the most humble of servants. And in the Mass, each person receives a wafer of bread, which according to the doctrine of transubstantiation, is really the body of Jesus. And the Eucharist is sometimes called Panis Angelicus, hence the name of the hymn. Sustenance from heaven. Specifically, the food described in the Bible as miraculously provided for the Israelites in the wilderness, manna. Spiritual food, not bodily nourishment. When the angel appeared in our meeting house, I recall some older Unitarians were uneasy about it because they just didn't like this dualism, body and spirit, spirit on a plane up there, so body to be on that account to be looked down upon. However, it was a Sunday Club project. It would have been a rejection to take the mosaic down, and you can't explain arcane theology like transubstantiation to kids. And when I look at it, I don't think of holy angels who don't eat or drink or get tired or defecate. I see a rakish, non-white, very humane-looking angel. And as the guardian to the door to the kitchen, he or she, or I guess gender-fluid they, are as well-placed as possible in the confines of this meeting house. Now, in the Lord's Prayer, "Give us this day our daily bread," sticks out like granny's tooth in my mind. It comes between one load of theist thoughts about the kingdom of heaven and the will of God, and then a plea for forgiveness and the final affirmation of power and the glory of the kingdom of heaven. And in tenor David Hobson's version of the Lord's Prayer, it's the only line he doesn't sing. Did you notice? The choir does, very softly. It's like a little plea for humanity in the body, in the midst of a whole lot of high-powered spiritual stuff. So let's turn that up a bit. Metaphorically, bread as the staff of life. Food is essential for us all, and I'd like to approach the topic from the point of view of two of our principles. The second principle, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, and the sixth principle, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. In a world of profound inequalities, the sight of a starving child is an abiding shame. Many first world families don't regularly donate to save the children funds or respond to famine and distress appeals. Politically, countries like Yemen, Ethiopia, Niger, the Sudan are home to millions of starving children. However, starvation in the two biggest countries in the world has actually gone down. I'm talking, of course, about India and China. According to the World Bank, more than 850 million Chinese people have been lifted out of extreme poverty. China's poverty rate fell from 88% in 1981 to 0.7% in 2015, as measured by the percentage of people living on the equivalent of less than $2 American a day. Now, is India poorer than Africa? Well, one third of the world's poor is in India. It also has a higher proportion of its population living on less than $2 a day than even sub-Saharan Africa. 33% of the global poor are Indians, which equals 14 billion people. But even in India, there is another image of poverty which runs counter to the emaciated child. It's the fat one. Obese children, diabetic adults. Globalism has spread the ills of the West well into the third world by exporting the Western diet for profit. The usual suspects of these sort of things, popularised by multinational fast food chains. But let's dig in a little deeper. I am a typical Westerner, at the top of the overweight range, and I do not darken the door of a McDonald's or a Subway or Pizza Hut. I don't guzzle soft drinks. This is my picture of a healthy meal. What's missing? Bread. I like bread more than bread likes me. Toasted sourdough, Turkish bread or a bagel with stuff on it like avocado, roast eggplant, olives, cheese definitely contributes to the dense, calorific style of my diet. In the 20th century, when were the Brits most healthy? When they were gorging on salad, fruit and veggies with a spot of fish and meat and cheese and protein added? Not on your Nelly. Recently, Christine Mason was given an essay which won second prize, written by her mother, and the topic was how to maintain a family on 30 shillings a week after rent. Cursive. No particulars of size of family having been given, I am planning for one similar to my own, only my husband's occupation will be such that he will be able to travel free and have uniform provided instead of having to arrange for these. The family consists of father, mother, two boys aged 7.5 and 5, and a girl of 1 year. Guess who the girl was? Christine. The arranging of the budget is a source of much thought. Food prices vary so frequently. Children's health and ailments often necessitate action, extras, calling for a quick rearrangement of one's program for the week. Then too, not only is the week's outlay to be considered, but the year in general, and the problem of trying to be in a position to meet any emergency which might arise. Districts and towns vary. In one place in which we lived, it was possible to take the week's washing to the public laundry, and for the sum of sixpence, we could have the use of as much hot water as necessary and take home the clothes, dried and sometimes even ironed. Then too, in another district, our doctor's bills were met by the London Public Medical Service, this costing 11 pence per week, 4 pence for mother, 4 pence for the first child, 3 pence for the second, and you can see how it carries on. So in this budget, there is no need to save for any need that might arise. So far as clothing is concerned, having a sewing machine and being able to alter and adapt my husband's discarded trousers and make new ones for the boys, who seem to wear through theirs so quickly. It is surprising what can be done when the need arises. My budget for this family is divided into food, £1, and other expenses, 10 shillings. And this is getting hard to read because it's cursive and very, very faded. But there's the budget, which you probably can't read. Food comes in with prices, and at the top of the list is bread, 4 large white loaves and 4 brown, 2 and 6, milk, 2 pints a day, 4 shillings, 2 pence and 3 farthings, pencil note says it's mostly for the kids, butcher and fish, 4 shillings, fruit and veg, 2 and 6, saving for seeds and jam, 4 pence, groceries, 6 shillings and a farthing. This was supplemented by some garden vegetables, but what planning? And there's no way you could have served up a plate of food like this. Christine recalls being given half an egg. Now, there can't be many people who would willingly return to the days of food shortages and rationing, but that doesn't usually stop older Brits from fondly recalling the stodgy puddings, bread and dripping and shepherd's pie of their wartime diet. And today, as we tuck into ready-made curries and lasagna, it's tempting to smile smugly and think we all know what's good for us now. But, as nutritional experts believe, it may be the nostalgic oldies know a thing or two. The Hamers family from Otley in Yorkshire went on a Channel 4 reality TV show and spent 9 weeks living in a 1940s house, doing 1940s chores and eating the severely rationed food. Dietitians have long argued that wartime rationing provided the healthiest diet the British population has ever eaten, leading to a dramatic post-war improvement in the nation's health, and rationing continued for 14 years in Britain. But now that ration books are consigned to museums, nutritionists still believe there are valuable lessons we can learn from the 40s diet that could help us beat some of the biggest threats to health today. The fact the Hamers lost weight and their short-term health improved confirms nutritionists' faith in the benefits of combining exercise and a diet high in carbs and low in fat. But most importantly, nutritional experts also argue that a return to aspects of the wartime diet could, for all of us, be the secret to surviving modern-day killers like cancer, stroke and diabetes. At first sight, the typical 40s meal of tiny meat portions, mounds of potato, carrots, cabbage and bread, followed by a stodgy pudding, may not sound like the pathway to true health. Yet at the start of the war, the average British diet, with its higher carbohydrate and lower fat content, was closer to modern recommendations than today's diet. The war brought food shortages and rationing. The diet improved further as people relied more on carbs, while fats and sugars in particular were severely restricted. Rationing began in the 40s and lasted 14 years. And since then, the Brits have relied less on carbs, more on fats, and enjoyed much more variety. Portion sizes have doubled. Grazing all day is easy because restaurants, cafes, and fast food outlets and supermarkets supply food 24/7. The improvement in choice and availability has done us no favours. Dietary advice is often dreadful. The low-fat recommendation led to massive increases in sugar consumption. in wartime, they had all that bread, but it was fibre-laden. This was replaced by softer loaves that keep longer. It's only recently been revealed that there are benefits to fasting, particularly for people interested in avoiding type 2 diabetes. My brother dodged that particular bullet by adopting the 5-2 diet and cutting honey, which he'd used for years, in his black tea. 5 days of normal eating and 2 days of extremely restricted diet, as calories, 600 a meal. So that's one meal and a snack. My point, though, is that that requires a lot of willpower. And whole populations of people are experiencing an obesity epidemic. It's accompanied by a big rise in autoimmune diseases. These have increased dramatically throughout Asia too, as the Western diet extends into China, India and elsewhere. We're not going to stop the juggernaut of global fast food chains easily, but does that mean we shouldn't try and exert some influence? The difference in death rates between rich and poor reached its narrowest gap in the 20th century, just after the war, before widening into its current gulf. In my teaching career, I ended up teaching in the leafy green suburbs after spending most of my career in socioeconomically disadvantaged schools. And what I noticed was the paucity of fat kids in richer areas. It's not about choices in education, it's about expense and availability. You want takeaway in Stirling? Well, there's one subway attached to a service station. You can get pizza in Aldgate, and I think there's a fish and chicken place in both. Go to Mount Barker and you've got McDonald's, Carl's Jr. Burgers, KFC, Hungry Jack's, Guzman and Gomez Mexican, Bubba's, Domino's, and I could go on. A third to half of every class of kids there is hefty. So the food environment is important. The councils in rich areas are more likely to reject applications to build fast food establishments because they're plug ugly and they create litter. Councils in less privileged areas are likely to think, jobs, yep, let them in. And in goes another franchise. So food is a social justice issue. Our government resists regulating food manufacturers. In the 1990s, many states and jurisdictions in America banned artificial trans fats. Others clung to their ideals of freedom and the health consequences, and Australia didn't ban them. Nor does Australia require that trans fat measurements are put on labels. But significant reductions were achieved by manufacturers. For example, there's been no trans fat in soft margarines for 10 years. Well, isn't that preferable, you might ask, rather than mandating? Dietitians like Rosemary Stanton think no, for the same reason I touched on before. Stanton argues that the problem with averages is that they ignore significant minorities. In this case, subgroups of people who are likely already suffering from health issues related to poor diet. The majority of Australians might have a trans fat intake of less than 1% of total energy, but according to a 2017 analysis of national nutrition, and that was done by Sachs for the Heart Foundation, about 10% of Australians, so that's 2.5 million people, continue to have an intake exceeding this level, and those people, of course, are socioeconomically disadvantaged. Researchers found that 14.2% of people with the lowest level of income and a similar percentage of people with the lowest level of education exceeded that World Health Organization cutoff. Eating a meat pie, a custard baked good, and a bit of popcorn a day could get you up to 7 grams of trans fat easily. That's 3% of your daily fat allowance, and that's well over the 1% World Health Organization cutoff. Part of the reason dietary recommendations and mandatory food labelling is so small, such small fonts, so confusing and misleading, is the involvement of food manufacturers. They fund research even in the CSIRO. That is not going to change in a day. The question is, how do we operate in today's food environment? First, I'm going to suggest a few ideas. One is that no one has the answers, but a few things are obvious. One is ultra-processed food is usually bad. Superfoods ain't super. It's a marketing ploy. Low fat on a label often means high sugar. Cutting added sugar is probably necessary. Cutting all carbs is not the only way to reduce weight. Keto is a way, not the way, to lose weight. Restricting fats is probably necessary, but the big issue is the quality of fats. And fasting is not necessarily a no-no. Recent experience and research shows that it doesn't necessarily drop a metabolic rate, placing the body into starvation mode, which was the argument that was used for years by dietitians warning people against fasting. Calorie-restricted diets do that, so the more you eat, better use you make of the smaller amount that you eat, and that's what's known as starvation mode. By contrast, a strict fast can actually lift the metabolic rate. If you translate that into caveman days, you can see why. If you've been without food for 16 hours, you need to be up and running after something with your spear. Calorie counting might be the enemy, as it leads to obsessing about food and discounting the fact that we need some calorie-dense food in our diets. We need fat. We need protein. If you can't read food labels because of the font and you have no specific problem like gluten or dairy intolerance, the quick rule of thumb is the longer the list of ingredients, the worse it is. Don't buy it. Go to the fruit and veg. You will recognise a pumpkin at 50 paces with or without your prescriptive sunnies. In the end, behavioural change is hard to achieve if you only have one driver, like vanity. It may work in the short term, taking off weight for the wedding. That's not an everyday motivation, is it? It might be time to top up on some spiritual practice. Thich Nhat Hanh taught us that you don't have to spend years on a mountaintop to benefit from Buddhist wisdom. Instead, he says, just become aware of your breath, and through that come to the present moment where everyday activities can take on a joyful, miraculous quality. You can relax at the chopping board. He famously taught that we could all be bodhisattvas by finding happiness in the simplest things, in mindfully peeling an orange, sipping tea. And he counseled students to eat slowly, enjoying the texture, the aroma, the tastes and sensation of eating a peach, for example. And not to combine eating with arguing, questioning or debating. So my final words on the subject are bon appetit and enjoy, enjoy, enjoy. Can you stand now for the benediction? Give us this day our daily bread, and lead us not into temptation. May we enjoy the fruits of the earth and the joys of nature and home and hearth. And for your enjoyment at the end,
is it worth the waiting for?
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.
Yeah.